I'm Anthony Pastore. Welcome to UBS On Air. This is the Global Investor Forum, where every month we invite global investment leaders from the fund management industry to challenge our UBS house view. We address global financial questions and take an in-depth look at the broader industry. On today's episode, Frederick Mellers, a strategist with UBS Chief Investment Office Global Wealth Management, discusses the upcoming European parliamentary elections and Mario Draghi's succession at the European Central Bank, as well as its implications on policies and what it means for the euro and for investors. His guests are Stephanie Kelly, senior political economist at Aberdeen Standard, and Salman Ahmed, chief investment strategist at Lombard Odier IM.
Okay, welcome everyone to this month's Investor Forum podcast. My name is Fred Mellers. I'd like to begin with you, Stephanie, and just ask, how do you see this week's election playing out? Clearly, there's a big expectation that the fringe parties, namely the right, pick up a number of seats and the centrists lose a number of seats, which has big ramifications for the European Commission and policy going forward. Would you be in that camp, that consensus view, or do you have something different?
Look, I think when it comes to the European elections, it's probably worth bearing in mind that yes, populist parties are likely to increase their vote share. I would expect that. I think the polls aren't lying when they tell us that. However, in terms of actually what does this mean for investors, it just really warrants bearing in mind that these populist parties, populism by itself is a kind of a thin ideology, right? There's no specific, this is exactly what populists believe in. It's just a kind of a tendency to represent people in a certain way. So when people talk about this populist coalition coming together in Europe, that would be actually really difficult to do because these far right and far left parties across Europe have very different focus, right? So the AfD has a very different focus to the Lega in Italy. So when you look across countries, it's very hard to say how they come together easily. Now, does that make policy difficult? Yes. Is policy usually difficult in the European Parliament? Yes. So really for me, what this means is in normal policy times, it makes it slower getting things passed. Crucially, if they can get to that 33%, they're able to block quite effectively certain elements. But I think for me, really, the biggest implication for investors is going to be what this does to the national political sphere in the short term. Yeah. And what I mean by that is how does the Italian Lega Party doing very well affect the outlook in Italy? And I think that's where we're going to see the genuine political risk. That doesn't mean on the day of the elections you won't see a market reaction because headlines will be swirling about the rise of populism. But when you look brass tacks at the European Parliament and the way it's structured, what we're talking about is more policy stasis than policy transformation.
Yep. So in saying that, I guess a few years ago, there was a big fear that populism could eventually lead to a breakup of the euro. But now you're hearing populists not so campaigning on that platform, but it's more about trying to reform the EU within so they can pick up some sort of influence within the European Parliament. They can then set their own agenda. So would you agree that the downside risks to this election, I guess, are not as great as what they may have been in the past? However, the ramifications for broader European politics, it's essentially going to be a very slow kind of moving development over time.
I think that's a pretty good way to characterize it. Basically, there's an important difference between Europhobia and Euroscepticism. And as you pointed out, what a lot of Europhobic parties have done is have moved more to be more moderate and to be more Eurosceptic. So that means reforming, not outright just leaving tomorrow. I think that if you look at, again, at support levels within key risk countries, for me, Italy is the key risk country for populism in Europe. Support for leaving the Eurozone is just not high. And you can see that in the way that Lega and M5S have changed their way. Now, I would caveat this with one case, which is in crisis, that's where the populist impulse becomes more of a source of uncertainty for investors. Because if you have a populist government in government in Italy, for example, and you were to see them come up against significant financial crisis and want to do things like major fiscal expansion, does the European Commission reacting to them create actually more of a risk that Italy leaves? Yes, relative to a regular moderate party, for sure. And so I think it's more, again, same with the European Parliament, in crisis, can this Parliament act to do the things they need to do to fill the holes in European infrastructure? My fear is that they won't be able to because of the nature of this populism. So it's that Euroscepticism in normal times is no major issue. I mean, it's not good for sentiment, but it's not an immediate source of crisis. But in an economic downturn, a severe one, I think that's where you start to see the real power of the populist play out.
Okay. And Salman, how are you seeing it at the moment?
I think I agree with the Stephanie's characterization, but I would think that this is probably the first time that you would see populism starting to shape the mandates of key institutions. And let me elaborate that a little bit. So in this election, the consensus view is that we'll get 30% of vote for the populist parties. This is up from 22%. So if there is another crisis, as Steffi mentioned, or a recession, then this share is likely to go higher.
Yep.
But having said that, we are already going to see, depending on whether they get 30% or 35%, already a discussion and a debate on who the next chair of ECB will be. So already this is impacting, you know, key institutions. I think the next step is on ECB policy itself and the general framework which the ECB uses. Because I think everybody now is well aware that ECB is out of policy options if a severe downturn happens. Now, the question is, if ECB policymakers think that this populism will continue to rise and will threaten their mandates, what do they do now to reduce that probability that it happens at some point in the future? And I think the dovishness we have seen so far will become much more embedded. And in fact, it is probably the only guarantee that this European project continues to go forward. Because if we have a hawkish element or a hawkish shift combined with populism and a economic downturn, that would be a very damaging situation for Eurozone.
Yeah. So I guess related to that, the consensus at the moment feels that Manfred Weber,
yeah,
the German conservative, is in the prime position to take over the European Commission presidency. And in the past, the so-called Spitzenkandidat has typically, it's been a bit of a non-event. Whichever faction wins the largest majority, it's essentially their candidate takes over as the presidency. But here we now have a situation where populist parties could quite easily build up, as you guys have both been saying, quite a sizable position within the parliament, and they may disrupt that a little bit. So do you feel that Manfred still is the prime candidate, or could we see a surprise here?
I think if we get the 30% consensus vote, which is expected, then I think Manfred is still the core candidate. However, if we see C is going to 260, which is around 35% of the vote, I think then there is the whole domain is open. And then that creates a lot of permutations in the sense that if Germans do not get the European Commission president, then
exactly
who they get and what is the implication for ECB chair. And I think that is a short-term and a medium-term risk, because that can have a structural change in terms of how the ECB approaches its policy framework.
Yeah. And do you see the same thing, Stephanie, that let's just say we get a German in the European Commission. Is it as simple as then getting a French person at the ECB?
I mean, it sounds trite to say, but somewhat, yes, you do tend to see the kind of political countries playing off against one another in terms of leadership. Because, I mean, you can understand it shouldn't, you know, it looks bad if every single senior leadership member of the Council, Commission and the central bank are all from Germany, for example, right? That is, so there is good reason for the way it is. The one thing to flag on the Spitzenkandidat is that actually even the system by which you elect the Spitzenkandidat may well change. And this is the important thing, is what you're seeing is central kind of what you would call like the Angela Merkel style leaders are actually calling into question the way in which these kind of processes are being run. And part of that comes off the back of populist parties having taken issue with the route by which you get a Spitzenkandidat and you end up with the European Commission president. So against that backdrop, there might actually be space for more disruption than people are expecting. Again, I think the Commission candidate the Commission president is really important for setting the tone for policy. It's worth bearing in mind that Parliament plays a role in ratifying legislation, but it's actually in the Commission where you see most of the idea generation and drafting of that legislation. So there's a tendency to kind of say, well, the Commission president will be this, so really the ECB president, that's what we're interested in. But actually the Commission president in itself has an important role to play in terms of investor fears about the Eurozone and its inadequacy in terms of its level of integration as it is. So I think that's one to watch.
So I guess a lot of market participants at the moment, particularly those who are, let's say, long European risk, either through credit, peripheral government bonds, or FX, fear the scenario where we might get a Barnier or a French person in the European Commission, which inevitably might lead to a German at the ECB, and specifically Jens Weidmann. How would you see this scenario playing out for the markets? Would we get the initial risk-off moves in European assets because Weidmann is renowned as a bit of a hawk, but then ultimately things settle down because we recognize that we still have a situation of very low growth and inflation in the Eurozone and structural issues, and everything reverts back and Weidmann essentially just takes a consensus position and supports assets and the market in that sense?
I think initially, the reaction will be negative, because I think if the consensus is set that there will be a non-German position, which just seems to be the consensus at the moment. And I think, however, I would take you back to 2012 when Mr. Draghi made that famous off-the-cuff remark about whatever it takes. The power of that remark came in because Angela Merkel or any other European government head did not come and contradict him. Yeah. So there was an indirect endorsement of that policy stance. So I think I'm a bit skeptical that having a German per se means that you will have a structural shift towards hawkishness. What you may have is that that on the margin the view is taken a bit more hawkishly. But the critical test will come in when the next crisis happens.
Yeah.
Because right now the policy setups are there and the calibration is there. So to be able to get out of that, you need to look at your inflation numbers. They are nowhere near target. So I'm not quite sure what narrative anybody will have to spin to justify a shift in stance. But the critical question would be, if there is another downturn, what new policy options, like Mr. Draghi seminally opened a huge set of new policy options, not new ones because the US had already done them, but that will be the real test of that, whether that philosophical constraint hinders the new president or not. But I would just mention before I end this remark is that, given the rise in populism and the fact that it will eventually question the mandate of the ECB, I think that will be a powerful force in bringing everybody together, that they will have to do something to support growth if fiscal policy is not available.
So, Salman, how would you be positioned in euro-dollar going into these up-and-coming political event risks?
So I think in the euro-dollar, we are negative because we are expecting the dollar rally a little bit because of the trade war. So it's a bit easier right now. Yeah. But I think if we get 30% or plus votes, then that's also a little bit negative for the euro-dollar. If we get noise towards the fact that who the next ECB chair would be, I think that's also negative euro-dollar, despite the fact that you may get a German, because that's the uncertainty which will, I think, dampen the sentiment towards European assets. So we are negative on the short term on euro dollar, but at the moment it's more driven from the dollar side.
Okay. And Stephanie, yourself, would you agree that even if we may end up with a German or a hawkish president at the ECB, the uncertainty of that for policy could be bearish for the euro, or would you think it would be bullish?
No, I mean, I think I would broadly agree. I think it is worth bearing in mind, crucially, that yes, the politics of the ECB president do matter, and yes, the Germans tend to be more hawkish than say, the peripheral European countries. But the reality that we are all existing in is a Eurozone of low growth and low inflation. And unless you have a significant conviction that basically growth is going to absolutely knock it out of the park next year, which we don't expect, or inflation is going to suddenly blow out, which we don't expect, then really these conversations around the risks, as you kind of flagged, yes, you might get headline risk on the day that it becomes a Weidmann. We don't think it's going to be Weidmann, but if it was to be Weidmann. But the reality of the policy constraints remain the same. It becomes much more a case of, in crisis, how does the ECB react? And I think the other thing absolutely crucial to bear in mind is, ECB president has a really important role in communicating with markets, and that is absolutely really important. But the actual central bank policy making decisions will be led by a group, and that's always worth bearing in mind as well.
So if you guys don't think it's Weidmann, who do you think?
We think it'll probably be Olli Rehn.
Okay.
He's a Finn, right? So that's kind of a sort of a middle ground candidate for a lot of people, relatively well experienced, all that kind of stuff. So again, I don't think that's massively out of consensus to think that Olli Rehn has a decent chance. But crucially, the question is, who will be the European Commission president?
Okay, Salman, you kind of mentioned this a little bit before, but we all know the ECB's toolkit is starting to look quite empty.
Yep.
They obviously have their forward guidance. We know the TLTROs are coming. We don't know the terms of the TLTRO. And of course, there's tiering that's on the table. What possibly could they do in a scenario where European growth and inflation continue to trend down?
I think the recent slowdown in manufacturing shows that Eurozone is exposed to global cyclical factors. And if you look at the toolkit as we discussed, I think it's looking empty from I shouldn't even say traditional, but because they include new traditional policy maneuvers. But I think they should look beyond TLTROs or the LTROs if they happen, depending on whether the calibration is probably going to be on the easing side and the tiering or deposit rates. I think they are not hitting the ballpark type of policy maneuvers. They are signaling mechanism more so that we are going to support growth and I think indirect way of producing a forward guidance that rates are not going higher anytime soon. But I think if you want a proper bazooka this time around, I think they will have to think about targeted lending to certain sectors of the economy, because we have to also remember why this populism is coming to the fore. It's one of the major reasons is inequality, and I think this debate has to start in monetary policy circles that the QE programs had a massive impact on inequality and then obviously shapes political outcomes. So they have to take responsibility for it. So targeted, I think, credit lending, which is basically extending TLTROs to the next logical step. Yeah. They already started doing it. Now they have to take it to the next step, whether you're focusing on SMEs or, lower middle income class segments. And now the debate would be whether this is fiscal policy or not. Mm-hmm. But I think ECB already did quasi-fiscal when it in 2012. So it's a next logical step. And I think if the next crisis happens, then money finance fiscal has to come on the table, because otherwise I don't see any other policy option left on the table whereby it will have a huge impact on growth.
So I already asked you a difficult question on euro dollar.
Yeah.
And Stephanie mentioned that Italy is obviously the elephant in the room when it comes to European politics. How would you be positioned in BTPs going into these events?
So we have been negative Italian debt for the last couple of months, because I think technically the market was stabilizing at 270 basis point of spread at the 10-year level. And I think the European parliamentary election noise has been played out the most in Italy because of their economic situation. And I think depending on what Salvini's group does in this election, and he gets emboldened, as Stephanie mentioned, then I think the probability of another round of election in Italy is pretty high.
Yeah.
And that will also embolden them to take a much harsher stance with the European Commission, which, by the way, will always on the card, because the deal which the Italian government did with the European Commission last year was a fudge. It was just to kick the can down the road. Nobody believed any numbers both sides were giving, and in fact the real numbers were way worse. So I think that confrontation is still on the table, and that does put Italian assets under constant pressure for us.
So Stephanie, if we have this Italian political risk, however, the view I'm sort of hearing from the two of you is that the ECB will have to do more kind of purchasing, more QE, more creativity. Why would we not just all buy Italian government bonds and close our eyes and enjoy the attractive carry?
I mean, I just think that Italian government, the Italian economy at the moment, or the Italian market, for me, is like the trifecta of investor risk, because you've got weak economic fundamentals, you've got high cyclical exposure, and you've got these political risks we talk about. Ironically, I actually, we think about this sometimes. At the moment, we've got what you might have once said is the kind of market's worst outcome, which I think it is. You have the five-star movement working alongside the Lega, both very different incentives, and so very focused on different fiscal policies, right? One wants to decrease taxes, the other wants to increase spending, so they just did both, right? Because they don't make a lot of sense together. So they just do their own thing and they just move forward. Now, No one, I don't think, was surprised by the fact that the fiscal deficit has not been the level that they promised the European Commission. And as you say, I think another fight is coming. However, if what happens is come October, November, you have this disagreement between the Five Star Movement and the Lega about how to enact the next year of fiscal, because at the moment their fiscal projections just look completely unrealistic for 2020. Against that backdrop, I think very much I would expect an Italian election in 2020, likely spring 2020. In that world, if the Lega could actually get a larger share of the vote, potentially share with some of the smaller centre-right parties, Forza or Brothers of Italy, I think that actually in that environment, that's not the worst market outcome, because we are living currently the worst market outcome. However, the uncertainty that election campaigns bring themselves and the risk that you get a race to the bottom between the Lega and the Five Star through that campaign means that couldn't be assumed to be a net positive. However, I think it is one of those ones you have to watch carefully. And in the absence of a massive race to the bottom on Europhobia between the two parties, an election campaign in Italy might actually create some upside for investors if they are interested in BTPs.
Okay, so last question. We can't have a podcast without mentioning Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So clearly we've just seen the news that the auto tariffs have been postponed for up to 6 months. And we had a bit of a relief rally on European auto stocks last week and European assets. Do you think auto tariffs are still very much on the US government's agenda at the moment? And we now just are in a bit of a holding pattern, but it will come back and become an issue at the end of the year.
Yeah, so I was actually in DC just a couple of weeks ago, right before Trump's tweet, and the broad expectation was that he would take advantage of the fact that he could use this 180-day extension clause, but that he would expect on the other side some kind of agreement quota. So if you look at the Trump playbook when it comes to autos, USMCA, so the new NAFTA agreement, has built within it a clause saying if Trump decides to implement tariffs, then Mexico and Canada are exempt so long as they agree to this quota. Same with South Korea. I would expect that Japan and Europe are facing exactly the same, and Trump has said basically that. So the question is, can you agree a quota which essentially doesn't limit the industry today, but maybe limits growth in the future? I think the reason, part of the reasoning you see for this extension is Trump has quite a few irons in the fire as it is with the Chinese conflict, with the Iranian conflict. And we know this again from the Trump playbook. It tends to be that he tries to focus on a single issue at a single time, or at least maybe two issues. And so our expectation is still that come in 180 days time, whenever the European and Japanese responses become clear, I would still expect Trump to at least use your auto tariffs as a lever in those negotiations, if not actually potentially temporarily implement them. I think actually longer term implementation is extremely difficult, because the biggest opponents to those tariffs are the American auto workers, because they know the importance of auto parts for their industry, and they know the importance of trade, full stop, for their industry.
Sure. Salman, any final thoughts on trade between US and Europe?
Yeah, I agree. I think the focus will be on China, because it's China is not just a trade issue, but Trump is also a presidential debate issue, a presidential election issue now. And you can see how he's attacking Democrats, and I think that's a single narrative. It does not it creates sentiments in US public which your EU auto tariffs just don't. Mm-hmm. And for me, that means that they are not that important.
Yep. Yep.
So that may create some room for, you know, kicking the can down the road on that one. I think they will revisit it after he if potentially wins the election in 2020. Mm-hmm. But right now is China, not only from a trade perspective, but also from a presidential election perspective.
Okay. Thank you very much, both Stephanie and Ahmed, for your time today. Hopefully our listeners have had some value out of today's conversation, and we wish you all a very nice day. Thank you.